It's Tuesday, November 9, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Reverberations from last week's midterm elections continue, and a good many of those now come from Iowa. Much of this was overlooked on the election night when reports and results were coming in, but now we know, looking across the nation, that ground zero for one of the most important votes that came in the midst of this midterm election, well, it arrived in Iowa. Ground zero was the judiciary. Voters in Iowa threw out three justices of the Iowa Supreme Court who had ruled in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage. Now, this meant, of course, that a courts-based strategy on the part of those who are pushing for same-sex marriage worked in a Midwestern state, putting Iowa first in the entire region as having legalized same-sex marriage. Now, polls have consistently shown that a majority of Iowans oppose the legalization of same-sex marriage, and they went to the ballot box on Tuesday of last week and removed three judges, using a constitutional mechanism that put this power in the hands of the people. Now, the complaints about the people having this power have been many, and they are very pointed. The latest comes in the New York Times, where in an editorial, that paper declares that it is a blow to the courts that the people had and assumed this power. I read from the editorial, "What made the Iowa outcome even more demoralizing is that this was a retention election, one that asked for a simple yes or no vote on whether to grant judges another term. These elections are supposed to spare sitting judges from competing in multi-candidate contests, making the process as apolitical as possible. It didn't work that way this year in Iowa or in many other states." End quote. The editors also say that the defeat of these three justices, quote, "is sure to make other elected judges shy from rendering controversial rulings, especially before elections." End quote. Now, when you think about it, in the context of a Democratic government, that doesn't make much sense. Here you have a newspaper editorializing against the public taking an action in keeping with its own convictions in an election. It is suggested this will have a chilling effect on judges in terms of making controversial decisions before an election. Well, now, that's really interesting because it's really an insult to the population of Iowa, to the voters there, who made this decision. But it is also another sign of the elitism that infects so many in terms of the intellectual classes who believe that judges should somehow be absolutely immune from the political process. Now, the only way that judges could be absolutely immune from the political process is if they never have to answer to the population at all. The situation in Iowa is exactly constitutionally what most judges and others of similar kind of authority would call for. In this case, what happened is that the people exercised the right that is theirs. In another article, John Schwartz of the New York Times reports that some gay couples are beginning now to launch a new legal challenge to the DOMA, that is the Defense of Marriage Act, that is now the law of the land, forbidding the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages. Now, as Mr. Schwartz writes, a couple in Connecticut sought to register for federal health insurance. One of the parties to this marriage, Joanne Peterson, tried to add her spouse. Now, same-sex marriage is legal in Connecticut, where this couple lives, but of course the Defense of Marriage Act does not allow the federal government to recognize the marriage and thus to accept her spouse under the federal insurance policy. Now, as Mr. Schwartz writes, two new lawsuits, which involve plaintiffs from New York, Connecticut, Vermont, and New Hampshire, expand the attack geographically and also encompass more of the 1,138 federal laws and regulations that the Defense of Marriage Act potentially affects, including the insurance costs amounting to several hundred dollars a month in the case of Ms. Peterson and Ms. Meitzen, and a $350,000 estate payment in the ACLU case. End quote. The American Civil Liberties Union is undertaking a similar lawsuit. The goal of all of these lawsuits is to invalidate the federal government's Defense of Marriage Act. We'll be watching this, but going back to the earlier editorial from the New York Times, what we have in the case of these lawsuits is another attempt to achieve a courts-based victory for same-sex marriage when it is not available legislatively. Elections come and go, but political analysis is perpetual. And of course, that analysis often follows by a matter of some days, months, or even years, a political event such as the midterm election of last week. But Stephen Thuma, writing for the Chicago Tribune from its Washington bureau, offers an interesting piece of analysis having to do with the disappearance of the middle. The headline of the article is, "Election Also Marked Decline of U.S. Centrists." He writes, about two dozen moderate to conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives were defeated Tuesday, leaving a more liberal party in Washington. Also, several moderate to liberal Republicans were turned out through the year, ousted by primary challenges from more conservative candidates and leaving a more conservative party. The result is a more polarized Congress. Now, that's both insightful and interesting. What we have in Congress right now is indeed a polarization. The Democrats most likely to have lost in this last election turned out to be conservative Democrats, and the Republicans who were toppled in primaries turned out to be more liberal Republicans. Therefore, the Republican Party is essentially more conservative than it was just a few weeks ago, and the Democratic Party is in turn more liberal. Now, where you go from there depends upon how you see politics. William Galston, who worked in the Clinton White House as a policy advisor, says that bit by bit, the center in American politics is getting weaker. He went on and said, elected officials are more polarized than the American people, but the American people are more polarized than they used to be. End quote. Now, there are many interesting aspects to this analysis, but one central fact is a matter of absolute attention when you see something like this. And that is that elections, indeed politics in general, is about a debate of ideas. And when the ideas become most focused, that's where the middle tends to fall out. Now, when you're dealing with many issues of procedural politics, the middle can hold. But when you get to the most basic cleavages in the population over the most basic questions of politics, the meaning of life, morality, economics, and all the rest, it's hard to find a center, much less to hold it. So in other words, we should expect in a time like this that the electorate, as well as those they elect, will become more polarized. That isn't all bad. Polarization is not the problem. Not when it leads to a vigorous and honest exchange of ideas. The political system works best when these ideas are dignified and clarified and actually put before the American people and their legislators in order that the issues can be understood and decisions can be made, and then responsibility taken. The disappearance of the middle in this sense is something that may trouble some political scientists, and the drama over it may make for some interesting headlines. But it'll be interesting to note as we look back in years to come that polarized governments have often done the best job of adjudicating and navigating difficult political waters. We'll watch this one. It'll be interesting to see. Jesse Washington of the Associated Press takes us into the practice office of Dr. Natalie Carroll, an OBGYN in Houston, Texas. I read from his report. One recent day at Dr. Natalie Carroll's OBGYN practice, 12 pregnant black women came for consultations. Only one brought a husband. Carroll spent time telling the mothers how they should care for themselves and why they need to get married. 72% of black babies are born to unwed mothers today, government statistics show. The girls don't think they have to get married. I tell them children deserve a mama and a daddy. They really do, Carroll said. End quote. Now, what Mr. Washington is talking about is an increasing willingness on the part of many African Americans to talk about the family crisis, indeed very specifically the crisis of children born out of wedlock. Now, it has become politically incorrect to talk about this, and ever since the Moynihan Report back in the 1960s, anyone who raises the issue has been accused of blaming the victim. But intellectual honesty requires the admission that a 72% birth rate of children out of wedlock is a social and moral disaster. It is an economic and a personal disaster for many African American mothers and their children. Now, that's not a universal opinion. Interestingly enough, Demetria Lucas, the relationships editor at Essence, the magazine for black women, said this. She said that plenty of black women want to marry but can't find suitable black husbands. Quote, if you can't get a husband, who am I to tell you no, you can't be a mom, she asked. On the other hand, Amy Wax, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, said this, blacks as a group will never be equal while they have this situation going on where the vast majority of children do not have fathers in the home married to the mother involved in their lives, investing in them and investing in the next generation. End quote. What we're seeing here is a growing awareness that we do have to talk about the reality and the importance of family, not only in the African-American community, where, by any statistical measure, this crisis is most acute, but throughout the civilization and the culture, where, in general terms, over 40% of all babies in this country are born out of wedlock. It is irresponsible not to talk about this crisis. Of course it steps on some toes. Of course it is an awkward conversation. But there is no hope for a society that can't talk about a problem of this magnitude in its very heart. The absence of fathers from the lives of so many children is an abject disaster. We can only hope that the kind of courage represented here by Dr. Natalie Carroll is infectious, a contagion caught by many others. Christians understand that marriage is not merely a sociological phenomenon of human evolutionary development. We understand that marriage and the family are institutions given to us by God for our good and for His glory. The rejection of any divine gift comes with a very great cost. Today's an important day in publishing history with the release of Decision Points, the memoir by former President George W. Bush. The release of a book of this magnitude is certain to get a lot of cultural attention. You're likely to hear a lot of chatter about the book. Already, advance copies were reviewed such that the nation's leading newspapers and magazines were able to give something of a hint of what is to come. As I'm speaking to you now, I've had an opportunity to take a quick look at the book, and I can tell you this, it's going to be compelling reading. It's going to be very interesting. Many of the anecdotes recorded in the book are sure to capture a good deal of attention. But the larger question has to do with the message of the book and the former president's interpretation of his own mind, of his own times, and of his own record. Presidents, in this case former presidents, write these books in order to place themselves in an historical context. This former president is famous for having said that he had little regard for his place in history. In the long run, he said, quoting economist John Maynard Keynes, "We're all dead." Well, this former president isn't dead. He's very much alive, and his book is likely to cause a good deal of conversation and debate. The chatter and controversy about this book is another sign, and this is a good sign, that books still matter. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter with regular updates at twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information on Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu, and for Boyce College at boycecollege.com. A daily list of links to the articles I mentioned on this program are available at the website at albertmoeller.com with every podcast. You can also sign up for a daily, more lengthy edition of links that come in a form of an email called The Briefing. To sign up, just go to mail@albertmoeller.com and indicate you would like to receive the list. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.